Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Brett Mabee. The Red Lake Nation just broke ground on what will be a new charter school focused on Ojibwe language and culture in addition to college readiness. The Coushatta Tribe of Louisiana is designing an immersive living history experience to give the public a better understanding of history and culture. They are among the projects spurred by millions of dollars in federal relief money. We'll hear more about that coming up right after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Art Hughes in for Antonia Gonzalez. A federal review committee is scheduled this week to consider whether remains and artifacts at the University of Alabama are tied to seven tribes who are trying to get the remains back. AL.com reports the committee can rule on whether the tribes are connected to the remains, but can't force the university to turn them over. The news outlet reports the Muscogee Creek Nation and the other tribes have tried to recover the remains from the Moundville Archaeological Park for years without success. Tribal officials filed a claim under the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, but say they continue to be hampered by bureaucratic red tape. The National Congress of American Indians issued a resolution calling for the university to turn the items over to the tribes. Archaeologists date the remains to 6,000 years ago. The university's spokesperson released a statement saying the university has worked with several tribes to return the ancestral remains and that they desire to continue collaborating with tribes on their requests. Michelle Latimer is dropping her defamation lawsuit against the CBC and four of its journalists. APTN News reports a court document doesn't explain why she is discontinuing the civil suit. Latimer is a filmmaker and former director of the Trickster TV series. She said she was of Algonquin, Métis, and French heritage, but the CBC reported that tribal officials questioned her indigenous identity. She resigned from the show, and her film, Inconvenient Indian, lost its distribution. While most tribal officials praised the recently concluded Tribal Nations Summit with the Biden administration, at least one chairman is strongly critical of the event. In a written statement, Cheyenne River Sioux Chairman Harold Frazier says he was prevented from expressing what he says is really happening in Indian country. Frazier's concerns were mostly centered around the Indian Health Service, complaining that COVID infections are creating serious problems. Frazier says Cheyenne River citizens are having to wait as long as 36 hours to receive life-saving treatment. For good or bad, Frazier says his tribe must rely on IHS, but the federal government's failure to honor its treaty responsibility is costing lives. Minnesota's governor appointed the first Native American to that state's Court of Appeals. Sarah Wheelock, a citizen of the Meskwaki Nation, was serving as the legal counsel for the Shakopee, Mattawakketon Sioux community. The St. Paul Pioneer Press reports Wheelock also previously served as an appellate judge on the White Earth Band of Ojibwe Court of Appeals and was an adjunct professor with Mitchell Hamlin College of Law. In a written statement about his appointment, Governor Tim Walz said Wheelock has repeatedly shown that she is a dedicated public servant committed to advancing the common good. This week, we are featuring the voices of several of the recent inductees into the Native American Hall of Fame. Among those honored was Ben Nighthorse Campbell, the former Republican U.S. Senator from Colorado. In an interview after the event, Campbell said whenever he speaks publicly to Native audiences, he makes sure to encourage them to run for office.
And we're gaining. When I was in Washington, the last Native person in Congress before me was a Rosebud Sioux named Ben Rifle. Ben served in 1976. Then he left, retired. I was the next one there. And all the time I was in Washington, House and Senate, I was the only one there. So I got elected from Colorado, but the word goes out through what we call the Moxton grapevine. And I sort of inherited a national constituency of Indian people from all over the country who had problems they needed help with. So our staff really did double duty trying to keep up with that.
That was Ben Nighthorse Campbell. The interview was recorded by Andy Murphy. Campbell served 22 years in public office. He was first elected to office as a Colorado state legislator. He went on to represent Colorado's 3rd congressional district. He then served as a U.S. senator from 1993 until 2005. He was the first Native American to ever lead the Indian Affairs Committee. With National Native News, I'm Art Hughes.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
There are now booster recommendations for all three available COVID-19 vaccines in the United States, and you may choose which booster shot you receive. More info at aaip.org or cdc.gov/coronavirus, who support this show.
Support by BNSF Railway, proudly supporting the nation's economy by moving the goods that feed, supply, and power communities across the country. More at bnsf.com/tribal relations.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. From the Allegheny Territory of the Seneca Nation, I'm Brett Mabee. The Crow Language Consortium is developing textbooks, dictionaries, and posters, all in an effort to preserve the Crow language. Absalokan for future generations. Money from the federal government in the form of COVID relief aid is helping boost that effort. Right now, the consortium is collecting recordings of fluent speakers, among other projects. And the Red Lake Nation is breaking ground on a new building to house their Ojibwe language immersion school. That's also thanks in part to federal relief money. These are just two of the dozens of language and culture programs getting some added strength from the influx of emergency funds. We're going to hear about them coming up this hour, and of course, we want to hear from our listening audience as well. What language programs are working in your tribe? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-996-2848. That's 1-800-99-NATIVE. Joining us from Billings, Montana, is Janine Pease. She is in the Valley of the Chiefs District of the Crow Indian Reservation in Montana, also known as the Lodge Grass Area. She is founding president and faculty member at Little Bighorn College, and she is the board chair of the Crow Language Conservancy. She is a Crow tribal member. Welcome back to Native America Calling, Janine.
Sure, Dad. Get chicked alone. Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
I'm excited about our conversation today. As I was telling you before we kick things off today, language revitalization, language immersion is something that I'm extremely passionate about. And I'm guessing, this has been a passion of yours for a long time. You've been working on Crow revitalization for several years. What are some of the developments that you're working on right now?
Well, probably the most that we're emphasizing right now is materials development for our dual language and our language immersion classrooms. And we work together with public and private Catholic schools, as well as our Little Bighorn College, our tribal college. So we have a big partnership, but we've really been able to take a step forward with these ARP funds through the National Endowment of the Humanities and through the Administration for Native Administration. We're going to take some steps forward with a series that our children can learn about our Crow history, a timeline over from time immemorial right up to the present, as well as a Crow Heroes series to learn about our people throughout all the eras. And then also we're planning to publish a student dictionary that will come from our multi-year work on a dictionary, on the Saloka dictionary. We're very, very excited to be able to bring these things to the classroom through the ARP funding.
How long have you been working on language revitalization, Janine?
You know, we put our language consortium together in 2011. We began to meet about how it would be an advantage for us to exchange our language materials. Many of the schools had started dual language and language immersion classrooms, especially at the early childhood level. And so in 2014, we started our nonprofit. And from that time forward, we have been able to realize mutual progress. Right now, we have 24 classrooms where the language is being taught. 14 of those are at least half a day in the Absalokia language. And they start from pre-K all the way through third grade. And then we have Crow language being taught as a modern language at the middle school and high school levels. And probably the most auspicious project, of course, is our language immersion classrooms. And we're very, very thrilled about that. We've developed materials that approach language teaching in a contextual format. And our students are learning anywhere from 1,000 to 1,500 vocabulary words in context every year at three different major levels. And then the next major development was our dictionary project. We called our language speakers and our elders together in the summer of 2018 and had a rapid word collection project whereby groups of elders and speakers, maybe four or five of them, were given a word that would be like a word association, let's say, like hand, and all the words in the Absaloka language relating to hand or injury or a particular, like, mother, okay? And we collected, our goal was to collect over 2 weeks, 10,000 words. And in 2 weeks, with about 65 elders and language speakers, we collected just short of 15,000 words for a dictionary. And we recorded the speakers. We wrote down the words, and all the people in these groups had to agree about how they were written as well as how they were pronounced. So from that time up to today, we now have an online dictionary that records and puts all of that out to our Absaloka public and anyone, because it's a free app. And Bob Rue is on the program today. He's really the expert in the technology of how that has been placed online. So we're really happy to have that dictionary as a matter of our offering it to all of our classrooms, our students, and really our speaker public in our Crow Nation.
It certainly sounds like you have pretty much all of the bases covered. You have the little ones all the way up through the college age, and of course you're working closely with the elders in the community as well. Coming from, as most Indigenous nations, or pretty much 99% of Indigenous nations, we're all oral. Has it been an easy process getting things written down as well, phonetically and things of that matter?
Well, we were fortunate to have a number of cadre of young folks, scholars, go to Massachusetts Institute for Technology, MIT, in the mid-70s. And they originated an orthography using the International Syllabary. And really, our language has been written, but not as broadly as it is by now. So that happened in the mid-70s. We have basically come to a point where developing a dictionary was something that we could do with our speakers. Many of them were literate and are literate in the Crow language, although there are older members of our tribe who have never written or, are readers of the Crow language. But we are, it's some struggle there, but when we had this assembly of elders and speakers, they agreed on spellings, and they agreed on how they'd be pronounced, and all of that has been put into our dictionary. So we're very fortunate that cadre of young scholars that went to MIT did that development in the 70s. You know, we stand on their shoulders in this development with our dictionary.
It's encouraging to see such great support from your nation, and you're building on a great foundation, and things have been able to accelerate a little bit. You recently received some federal emergency aid, the ARP money, for your work. How are those funds being utilized?
You know, we're real excited. We have an ARP grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities for the books. We're very anxious to have our language immersion materials be in all disciplines. So this will help us in social studies, and the humanities. We're going to do a Crow history timeline that talks about all of our major points in history from time immemorium all the way up to the present. So we're very excited about that. It'll be for early childhood and intermediate grades. And the second set, the series, will be about Crow heroes. You know, in our schools, we study about American heroes, and even in our states, we study about heroes. But this will be a series that talks about our notable and noteworthy Absaloka people. Biluga, we call it our Absaloka people. So we're very anxious to have that series as well. They'll go hand in hand. And we're so excited to have our children have role models from our tribe, from our people. And that's the National Endowment for the Humanities grant. We'll be doing that with our teachers who are teaching the children at those levels. And over the next couple of years, we'll be developing those two series, the History Timeline and Heroes. And the second project is an ARP grant from the Administration for Native Americans. And that will be working on elaborating our Level 2 textbook, which we've been using for a number of years now. But it'll expand the vocabulary that we'll be able to and the context that we'll present in that level. And the student dictionary, that is one that can go into the classroom, be at student desks, and have a wonderful impact on our students' ability to read and write the Crow language. So we're real excited about these two grants, and it really expands what we have in our classrooms with our teachers to really, you know, work on our students and our children's capacity in the language.
This all certainly sounds exciting. And before our time today is up, I want to talk a little bit more about the story of Crow Indians, the past to the present. The book that's going to be published in the coming, we'll save that for just a little bit. I also am anxious to bring on Bob Rue, who you were mentioning you were working closely with. We'll have to wait for just after the break. And as always, I want to throw this out as well. You're listening to Native America Calling. We'd love to hear from you today. Call in at 1-800-996-2848. You can also reach out on Facebook at Native America Calling or on Twitter at 1-800-99-NATIVE. We'll get your comments on the air. Post a pic on Instagram at Native America Calling. We have to take a short break. We'll be right back. Billions of dollars from the unprecedented $1.2 trillion federal infrastructure bill are headed to tribes. Projects for drinking water, sewers, and broadband connectivity are high on the list. We'll get a picture of the opportunities for what many tribes are calling a historic opportunity. That's on the next Native America Calling.
I feel happier when my children and grandchildren spend time with me or someone comes to visit. We also need to stay active to keep our spirits alive. As elders, our teachings are needed more than ever. The more we're socially connected with family and community, the less health problems we'll have, the longer we'll live. Remember, you're not alone. Connected together, we'll stand strong. More on elder isolation and caregiver resources at connectedindigenouselders.org. The National Indian Council on Aging supports this show.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Brett Mabee. We know the importance of language in preserving tribal culture. Recently, the federal government recognized that importance as well by allocating COVID relief aid to dozens of language and cultural revitalization programs. We're taking the opportunity to hear from two of those today, and you're welcome to join us as well. The number is 1-800-996-2848. That's 1-800-99-NATIVE. If you're just now tuning in the first segment, I was getting caught up with Janine Pease of the Crow Indian Reservation in Montana. She is the founding president and faculty member at the Little Bighorn College, and she's also on the board chair of the Crow Language Conservancy. They have so much going on, and it's exciting to hear how some of these emergency allocation funds are being used towards language revitalization as well. And as we were mentioning, also joining us from Montana is Bob Rue. I'd like to welcome him onto Native America Calling at this time. He is the publications director at the Crow Language Conservancy. Welcome to Native America Calling, Bob.
Thank you, Brett.
Well, Janine certainly hit on a lot of the overarching work that is going on with the language revitalization. However, you specialize in, well, as Janine was mentioning, how a lot of this got online, but also some of the changes that have come about because of COVID. I was wondering if you would care to expound on some of your participation a little bit.
Sure, Brett. Well, come February, March of 2020, we were, you know, dealing with how to handle the COVID crisis. I'm actually located in Bloomington, Indiana, not in Billings. So we go back and forth to Crow Country, you know, several times a year, and we were not going to be able to do that, obviously, because we didn't want to risk anyone's safety. Thankfully, in December of 2019, our IT department here had come up with an application that we called the ReRecord Application Collection Tool. And with that, it's like a local application on a laptop. We went out there in December and got recordings in a group setting with maybe, you know, 4 to 5 speakers and elders, and it was a great process because we were able to get information from several people at once, where we were able to get consensus on definitions, consensus especially on, you know, pronunciation. And all that data and recording was then uploaded onto Google Drive, and we were able to use it immediately in our offices. Well, once COVID hit in 2020, we had to kind of rethink everything. So we used the same application, and in the summer of 2020, we flew out 5 laptops and 5 high-quality microphones to the reservation and set them up in various locations in schools, and also to facilitate a family of the community who was one of our main speakers and had to leave their home due to a house fire. We set them up in a hotel room in Billings. So with that, we were able to, via Zoom's share screen and remote control desktop features, we were able to monitor and control all of the recording of all the dictionary data from our offices in Bloomington with people in Montana. And it worked out really, really great. I was a little reticent at first and apprehensive, but we just got some of the best recordings we've ever had, and we were able to chat and talk at length about every entry, and then just bring all of that information back into the office and put it into our dictionary. In January of 2021, this year, we used the same application again to get verb inflections for all the verbs in our dictionary. So for close to 4,000 verbs, we were able to get inflections, meaning, you know, first singular, second singular, first plural, second plural, you know, I run, you run, they run, type of verb conjugations or inflections for close to 4,000 verbs, which is just amazing that we were able to do that and not be on location. We were able to do it remotely from Bloomington. And all that information was then immediately merged into our dictionary software. And, you know, basically all we had to do was review it, and then it was ready to publish. And we will also be planning on doing another re-record for the remaining dictionary words where we don't have recordings sometime in the next couple of months. So with this process that we've come up with, we really are able to do this type of dictionary work either through the re-record tool, or we've also come up with a rapid word collection tool, doing the same thing that Janine had talked about prior, but actually doing it, you know, through a microphone and computer in a remote location from our offices here. So, you know, virtually we're able to do this anywhere that has, you know, a reliable internet connection. And we do have a rapid word collection that we will be doing virtually with the Tahltan community in British Columbia. And we've also done this with the Stoney Nakoda community in Alberta and the Ute Mountain Ute community in Colorado.
Bob, is this a permanent way of doing things now? I guess since the COVID pandemic took over and you were forced to kind of go back to the drawing board?
That's an excellent question. And I like to say that this really kind of revolutionized field recording. I put field in quotations because we're not really in the field, actually. But I do think, you know, it's going to be the way of the future, for sure. And nothing really, in a way, beats face-to-face, but this is certainly the second best thing.
You know, within the last decade, I've seen studies be published that deal with Indigenous languages and their decline a lot of times due to the embracing of technology, especially and particularly among the younger generations. But essentially what your work is doing is to help try and bridge some of that gap and make the technology more of an ally than a distraction, yeah?
Exactly. We're using technology to our advantage. We are also doing a print version of the dictionary. It's an 11,000 entry dictionary, which should be published sometime early 2022. Janine had mentioned that. But the majority of people who really need to, you know, be learning the language is going to be young people who, you know, are going to primarily be using their phones or sometimes their computers.
A lot of times there's been a little bit of a schism because, of course, the older generations, and I can completely understand where they're coming from, that in order to truly understand it, you can't see it written on a page. You have to hear it. You have to live it. You have to experience it. But that's part of the message from the youth as well, right? That, you know, we also have to incorporate our styles of learning that we're so used to in order to make this mm-hmm. work.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I also think that these applications, either vocab building applications or dictionaries or any type of like narrative material that is accessible through media, it's just one tool in many. And Janine had mentioned, you know, about all of the schools, you know, previously when she was speaking. And immersion school. So really, the immersion and the oral speaking is you know, truly the best way to learn this. But what these are just tools to facilitate them.
Absolutely. Before bringing our next guest on, I also want to, again, throw this out to the listener. We want to hear from you today. There's very little that I'm more passionate about than language revitalization. The same can be said with all of our guests today. So be sure to give us a call at 1-800-996-2848. I want to hear how language revitalization is happening with your tribe, especially your triumph stories, your stories that are going to help lift us up as well, because this is part of the fun of the conversation. And I'd like to follow that up with, I hope that you're feeling inspired by this discussion today and maybe take a few ideas away as well. Joining us at this time from Red Lake, Minnesota, is Nate Taylor. He's the director of the Red Lake Nation's Immersion Program and founder of Red Lake's Charter School. He's a citizen of the Red Lake Nation. Welcome to Native America Calling, Nate.
Uh-huh.
Nate, Red Lake recently broke ground on the building to house the Charter School. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about this project.
Sure. Name is Nate Taylor, the Red Lake Indian Reservation, the Red Lake Bandit. And when we speak our language, our ancestors, when we honor our ancestors, we honor ourselves. So we're creating a school with the mission statement is to prepare each student for college with an enhanced knowledge of the Ojibwe language, culture, leadership, and environmental stewardship. So I believe deep in my heart that if you're not giving the kids who they genuinely are, it's a disservice to their humanity. And I believe we're on a mission. It's just, you know, the teaching done by us instead of to us, in the sense that we're going to acknowledge all of the standards, but then we're going to take it to another level. So our goals are environmental sustainability, college and career readiness, health and wellness, leadership development, land-based learning, and experiential learning community engagement. So that experiential learning and that land-based learning, I always talk about there's an umbilical cord that goes to the stars, the land, to our ancestors, and I believe that that land-based learning is going to reconnect us. And
Nate, this certainly sounds like a great holistic approach to education. And, you know, looking forward into the generations, I'm pretty confident that the rest of the Western education will catch up to what's happening with Indigenous nations right now. So I'm super excited for what's happening out at Red Lake right now. How many students do you expect? How many teachers?
Okay. So, sorry, I missed that last part. I was having a little bit of phone issues, but could you repeat that question?
Sure thing, Nate. I was just wondering how many students you expect at the immersion school, or at the charter school, excuse me.
86. We're going to start out K through 5. We're going to add on every year. So just to give a little history, our Wasabik Immersion School, we've been in operation for 7 years. That's a tribally funded program. And we've serviced 3- and 4-year-olds. But with the charter school, we're going to be mandated by the state. And so there's going to be new rules and new parameters on how we're going to approach this, but we're taking it to a grander level.
Most definitely. And what will the everyday activities look like for students at the school?
So land-based learning is just mainly that reconnection. So if you can imagine a turtle, there's 13 spots on that turtle's back, and there's 28, you know, they represent the days. So what we want to do is do as we've always done. So in the time of ricing, we'll be ricing, learning about ricing, learning about everything that we did throughout the eons, you know, and just reconnect in the most genuine way that we can. And then also keeping in mind, you know, that relationship and that understanding of that relationship, because that is so vital to the essence of who we are. Indigenized education.
Most definitely, Nate. What sort of challenges, now getting into the bulk of our conversation and discussing some of this relief money, what sort of challenges has your program faced because of the COVID-19 pandemic?
Oh, the distance learning. The distance learning has been a new beast, but at the same time, we adapted to it. And right now, we're in distance learning right now because there's been a spike here in northern Minnesota. So, you know, it's just getting. We're a people of community, and when we're not able to do that, it really hurts us. So, there has been, you know, pluses and minus with this. You know, our families have become stronger. I've heard, like, maybe last year there was a higher number of people out there collecting maple syrup, but they were doing it with their family. So there's pluses in there. But, you know, at the same time, it's just adapting to the challenges.
I know for, you know, somebody teaching my children Seneca language right now, when the pandemic hit, I hit the ground running, and I saw it as an opportunity to really teach some of what I felt was important as well. Obviously, you know, I had to keep up with them on their regular curriculum, especially in the public school with my older son. But then I was also able to introduce a lot of that more into what we were doing day to day. So I was really excited about that, and it certainly sounds like that's what's been happening with Indigenous nations all
over Turtle Island right now. So we were talking a little bit about the challenges that was faced because of the pandemic. And now, in the wake of that, there was some federal relief aid. How important is this relief aid in getting the project to the next step?
So it's a beautiful thing. Language and culture has shot up to top priority for our people. So a good example is when the vaccine came out, the elders were top, the speakers were on top of the list. And, you know, the art funding allocated for the school's building for $8 million. And, you know, that shows right there that the tribe is fully dedicated to getting these kids in. And we always thought seven generations down the line. So, you know, we realize that there's an emergency happening right now. We have less than maybe 100 speakers, fluent speakers left out of a population of 13,000 plus people. I mean, the alarms and bells are going off. Like, hey, we got to do something. How do we do that? We got to bridge this gap between the elder knowledge and our children. So that's what we're doing. And speaking the language and well, kids will be our leaders, and they'll be speaking the language, and it'll always be done for them.
Nate, your situation at Red Lake sounds a lot like our situation here on the Seneca Nation as well. We're going to come back and talk a little bit more. I also need to get Alex onto the show as well. So you're listening to Native America Calling. Of course, we want to hear from you today. Call in at 1-800-996-2848. That's 1-800-99-NATIVE. Every day, we tackle issues from a Native viewpoint. So tune into this station at this time every day. And you can also check us out on NativeAmericaCalling.com. Once again, we have to go to a quick break, but we'll be right back. I'm your host, Brett Mabee.
Seizures are a symptom of epilepsy. 1 in 10 people will have at least one seizure over the course of their lifetime. But the reality is that many seizures go unnoticed or are mistaken for something else. November is National Epilepsy Awareness Month and Native American Heritage Month. 51,000 Native Americans are living with epilepsy. You can save a life. Registration for a no-charge seizure recognition and first aid certification training is available at learn.epilepsy.com from the Epilepsy Foundation, who supports this show.
You're listening to Native America Calling. I'm Brett Mabee. We're talking about the importance of language preservation today. The number to join in on the discussion is 1-800-996-2848. That's 1-800-99-NATIVE. I do want to head to the phone lines in just a few, but I do at this time want to bring on our next guest, who's been waiting so patiently, also from Minnesota, is Alex Kmet. He is a founding board member of Red Lake's Charter School. He is also a citizen of the Red Lake Nation. Welcome to Native America Calling, Alex.
Hey, bonjour, Denoy Morgan and Doug. I'm watching Indian Dish Nakas, Magazine to them. Miss Quagamil is Agrakening and Don Jabab, a Pashkum and Nitagong and Tashinda, Nongom. Hello, my relatives. My name is Alex Kmet. I'm Eagle Clan from Red Lake Nation and currently living in Cloquet, Minnesota.
Alex, Nate was telling us a lot about how dire the situation is at Red Lake, and I hear so much of the same kind of a situation that we have going on here. And I know that we're not the only two. There are challenges for many tribes throughout Turtle Island. I guess, you know, what we were saying is that the focus does, there has to be a concerted effort to bring the young people more into the conversation. Of course, the charter school is going to help push that along. What are some of the benefits that you're seeing with kids who are immersed in the Ojibwe language?
Well, personally, I myself as an immersion educator, my background has mostly been in educating mostly college-age students, but later on, over the past couple of years here now, well, 2.5 years really, I had my own daughter, and I've been raising her fully in Ojibwe language. So I've been trying to create, I suppose, educational systems that will help to encourage that further. But I suppose the benefits that I've been seeing with her so far is, well, for one, you know, this is the first I've seen like a first speaker being raised. You know, all of all of my elders over the years, you know, that are first speakers, they're all in their, at least in their 60s. And, you know, it's kind of a different, yeah, definitely. So it's kind of a different, different experience as a second language speaker learner myself to raise a child in the language is, it's different than, you know, if I was a first speaker raising my own child in the language. So there's unique challenges to that. But in particular, I feel that Ojibwe language is our connection to our traditional system of knowledge. Ojibwe language, like other Algonquian languages, is a polysynthetic language, as linguists would call it, which means that it's built up of different, like each syllable or two is a part of a word. You know, our words are notoriously long, and I think that's a big challenge for most second language learners. But if you were to break it down into these smaller parts, you know, each breath that you're speaking actually has knowledge to it. It has a concept that's being communicated. And that's some of the most difficult things to really teach to, say, like, you know, a college age student versus, say, a child. A child can just pick it up and absorb it, and they understand those systems. You know, you don't need to teach them about the system of the language. They're already able to navigate it. An example of this, I was listening to the first guest, Janine, talking about their dictionary elicitation being kind of thematic, you know, talk about a hand and everything that's related to a hand. Our language is built up similarly in that we'll have a word part that specifically means hand, and then another part, say on the front, that denotes everything about the hand, that describes it, or says it, if it's moving. So in that same sense, this is also connected to our, as Nate was saying, with land-based learning, we have thousands and thousands and thousands of years of observation of the natural world that's built right into our language. If you were to follow our teachings, actually, you know, it's not necessarily even built off of our observations. This is what was given to us by the spirit since time immemorial. So, you know, by comparison, English is only, you know, modern English is only like 100, 200 years old. You go by beyond that, you're getting into Shakespearean stuff that I can barely understand. But when we get into, you know, our old Ojibwe, this is the way our elders speak. And when we start to navigate our environment through the lens of our language, we start to see so many things. We can observe so many things that maybe we weren't paying attention to before. You know, how is it raining? How is it snowing? All kinds of different ways of describing the natural world. And then we can connect our literacy, our math, our science, all that is reflected within our language. So I feel that language, that's one of our big gateways into our traditional system of knowledge. And that's not to say that that are people that are not fluent in the language or that don't know our language, that they don't have traditional knowledge. They definitely do. But this is our old way of being able to navigate that knowledge in a way that makes sense to us systematically.
It never ceases to amaze me the way that those that traditional DNA, I guess, if you will, that thousands upon thousands of years of history and genetic knowledge comes through even in ways, maybe on a subconscious level, as I think you were kind of alluding to, when, you know, with people who don't necessarily know the language or aren't fluent in the language, that knowledge still seems to come to the surface. And I think you hit on another important point, Alex, as well, which is that, you know, part of the challenge for an adult learner is having to undo some of the learning that we've undergone. It's easy for us to talk about the boarding school generation, but it's much harder for us to talk about us, you know, and our generations past the boarding school time frame, I guess, if you will. So we're talking about different approaches, and I do want to head to the phone lines here in just a second, but I do have one quick question for you, Alex. So we're talking about different approaches. What are these different approaches to teaching adults than teaching young children? Or are the concepts of language learning more or less the same?
Well, I think it depends on like say for adult learners or say college learners, a lot of like, you know, the later classroom learners, there's a huge time constraint. You know, you're getting like maybe a couple hours a week compared to say if you're going into an immersion program where it's, you know, fully within the language. At the adult immersion program that I work at, where it's a bit more of a like a finishing school for people that are kind of working to be immersion teachers themselves, we will spend about, you know, say 30 hours, give or take, over the course of a single weekend. And if you were to talk about how many classroom exposure hours in, say, a college classroom across a semester, it's also about 30 hours. So, you know, you condense that entire semester into, you know, a weekend sitting with your elders. You know, it's a huge time difference. But yeah, I think learning within the language too, you're getting everything within context. When you're learning with this kind of crutch of English to navigate all the grammar and everything, it all becomes more abstracted.
Alex, you're doing some important work. And again, I'm amazed with some of the similarities. You mentioned raising your daughter as a Ojibwe first language speaker. And we have a similar kind of situation out here with a woman who was in immersion and she gave birth and her daughter's first language is Seneca in our instance. She's taking notes. Are you taking notes as well? Are you putting this together in a way that can help other people kind of avoid some of the, you know, the trial and error, I guess, that you went through?
Yeah, definitely. I've been, and also I've got my daughter in a early childhood immersion nest. So we have a small cohort of other parents that are also doing the same, and we have weekly meetings with one another. But also, just over the past week or two, I was awarded a grant from the Northland Foundation in Duluth, Minnesota, to put together a small video project, which helps to document what I'm doing with my daughter, but specifically in the context of the intersection of language revitalization, parenting, and food sovereignty, since I've been working with a lot of organic gardening this summer and exposing my daughter to that, having her in the garden the whole time. So bringing it all back together with this land-based learning, indigenous pedagogies, all through language, and also doing it, you know, at the family level, you know, because that's, you know, our schools can't do it alone. We have to be doing it at the family level. Like it's a community effort. There's no communication without community, and there's no language without communication.
And there can't be any separation between that learning at school and that learning at home. Alex, I want to bring you back on. I also want to bring Nate, Bob, and Janine back on a couple more times before our time is up. And let's face it, we're fastly running out of time. At this time, I do want to head on over to the phone lines. Calling in from Fort Hall, Idaho, listening in on KISU. I'd like to welcome Shell, the Native America calling today. Good day to you.
Yeah, the thing is about, you know, like languages out here in the Intermountain West and throughout the West, there's maybe two tribes, some three, and there's some that are confederated tribes, there's several different tribes. And, you know, this past pandemic, you know, we lost a lot of speakers. And, you know, we're like some tribes are probably, you know, I don't know if they're holding on, barely holding on, but that seems to be the situation out here.
These are certainly challenges that a lot of us are facing. Janine, you know, I don't want to get too morbid or anything, but Janine, has this been a challenge that you're facing out at Crow Agency right now as well?
It's been a huge loss to us. COVID has taken over, well, probably 100 of our speakers and elders, and it really puts an urgency on our language work because all of our work has been, we've been recording the voices of men and women with all of our work, with all of our materials. And we're so fortunate to have done the dictionary project before the COVID-19 pandemic hit, because we have the treasure of the voices of our elders that have gone on to the other side camp, we call it. But it remains to be extremely urgent to bring in the voices of the people, not only word by word, but to record those narratives of their lives and the stories that, because every elder has so much to tell, so much to give. And so we're hoping that we can fold that into our projects, but it just introduces to us such a loss. And, you know, it's, our hearts are just broken. Among the people that were in our dictionary project when we had our rapid word collection, a dozen of those 65 are no longer with us. We're very fortunate to have had their contribution, but it really makes us realize the treasure of our language speakers that we have.
I think, I hope that this is another takeaway from today's show, is that sense of urgency. Also joining us on the line today is Ryan, listening in Newtown, North Dakota, listening in on KMHA. Welcome to Native America Calling, Ryan.
Thank you. I was trying to give encouragement to everybody, myself, and to let all the speakers and the people know that they're working with speakers on prayers and to hang in there and to keep working hard. I'm the president of the National Alliance to Save Native Languages, and this is Ryan Wilson. And I'm also the chair of the National Congress of American Indians Native Language Task Force. And letting you all know, many of us continue to work on the appropriation side with Congress, with the administration, and trying our humble best to make sure there's resources there. And for the rest of Indian country, just to use them as wisely as you can. And heard one of the speakers talk about immersion. I firmly believe, and our organization's committed to, that's basically what we believe is the only way we're going to save these languages and carry them on, is through creating these venues for immersion schools and making sure that they're funded and that these tribes that still have speakers have the resources to get that done. So I just wanted to share that. Love everybody and keep going. Don't give up.
Once again, that's Ryan Wilson, the president of the National Alliance to Save Native Languages, with some words of Gaidzonyuk, some words of encouragement as well. And I also want to offer my voice to anybody out there who's listening right now that, you know, the time is of the essence right now. Bob, one of the factors that you brought up, and again, we're fastly running out of time, so we got to keep it a little bit short. But Bob, you mentioned that these resources available, all you need is that high-speed broadband access. Is some of these relief funds going to go to helping community members have said broadband access as well?
I can't really speak directly to that. I would hope that they would, because really that's kind of the only way, you know, given the restrictions of COVID, that, you know, we can reach people and people can reach each other.
Most definitely. Thank you very much, Bob. Nate, one last question for you. What are you hoping to see in as a short-term goal, I guess? What's next for the charter school?
A strong system that is who we are, and then, you know, give our children what they need to survive the world, too. So our dream, our children have an eagle feather in one hand and a PhD in their other hand. They're just well balanced
around. I absolutely am also of the belief that there doesn't need to be any separation. In fact, I think to frame the discussion as having to choose, or having our youth choose between this or that, is part of the problem. So I'm so grateful for all of the efforts, both out at Crow and also with Red Lake as well. So thank you so much. And again, keep up the good work, as Ryan Wilson was also saying as well. That's all the time that we officially have for today. Don't forget that you can still get your comments on the air with us by posting a picture to Instagram or on our Facebook page. We want to hear from you. This isn't the last time we're going to be talking about language revitalization as well. That's all the time we have for our show today. I once again want to thank our guests, Janine Pease, Bob Rue, Nate Taylor, and Alex Komet. I'm back live tomorrow with another program about COVID relief aid. Hundreds of projects are benefiting from an influx of infrastructure money coming from the recently approved federal relief bill. We'll hear from some of the tribes making plans to fix longstanding problems, I'm Brett Mayden.
Buju, gidina manji owen da bizane dagwad, gida bindige biagaz jidaba ige siwan nananda wiego yen, kashkidino giza sung ma dagin zod, binish gichimani to giza sung, midas weyashinano gunagazid. Ganoje no kid in a shinabi akwazi wagamigung no waj jigikain daman, mawadishiwain healthcare.gov, gema ganoj 1-800-318-2596. Gaundinagadeg the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
Support by VisionMaker Media, presenting Community, Returning Home Through Togetherness, an online event and panel discussion commemorating Native Americans and Alaska Native veterans. Available for streaming 24/7, November 1st through the 24th. Native Americans and Alaska Natives are one of the most consistent demographics that risk their lives for a government that tried to eradicate them. Returning Home Through Togetherness is open to the public for online streaming with no charge at visionmakermedia.org as part of VisionMaker Media's 45th anniversary.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davis. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.